Hello, everyone, and welcome back to RPG R&D. I am one of your hosts, Jess Geyer. I'm one half of Wannabe Games, and I make tabletop role-playing games. And I'm here, as always, with my co-host, Craig Campbell. Hello, Craig.
Hi, Jess. I'm Craig Campbell. I am the owner of Nerdburger Games, and I make tabletop role-playing games, too. I find myself thinking, like, you should just, you pretty much say it exactly the same way,
yeah.
The intro, like, every time, like, all the same words. You could record it, and we could just start doing it and see if anybody
just
notices.
Drop it in.
See, every time, I've noticed just
if it's literally
slight hiccup
the same
in her voice every...
Yeah. But we are here with a returning guest here, Eddie. Hello, Eddie. Welcome back to the show.
Hello. Hi. Nice to see you guys both. I'm Eddie Webb. I also make tabletop role-playing games, shocking absolutely nobody in this audience. And what do? I don't even know what I do anymore. I do stuff. I make stuff.
Finding our creative outlets.
Yes. I mean, right now, I do a lot of work with Onyx Path Publishing. I do a lot of work with Artosaurian Games. I have a creator-owned game, Realms of Pugmire. I've worked on a recently released horror game called Curseborn. I'm worked in the video game industry as well. Stuff.
Stuff and things.
Stuff and things.
You know, it being creative is so important in times like these. Doing stuff and things, I think, is the way to keep us sane, you know, healthy. So yeah,
it's funny. This is not related to the topic at all, but I was chatting. I've had the privilege of mentoring a few students over the years, and so reached out to one of them to see how they're doing. They're having a rough time. And they're talking about how they found working on their tabletop game, designing their tabletop game, was actually an escape from some stuff that they had been going through. And I was like, yeah, man, like on one level, I've had to compartmentalize my life in a way that I can do creative stuff in a way that cannot be immediately turned into content or product, right? It's like I have to just do half-made shitty games that amuse me that no one else will see, because that is still fun and cathartic to me. And if I ever lose that, if I ever go, you know what, I don't really want to work on this stuff, I don't find that enjoyable or fun anymore, then maybe I have to have a different decision. But it has happened in 20 plus years, so far I think I'm doing pretty good.
I think that that's a good transition into our topic, because finding that little, those little places of joy, one of the most fun things to do when you're running a game is our topic of today. Craig,
that's
what
true.
Are we talking about? What are we chatting about today?
Yeah, we're going to talk about collaborative world building. There's many a GM out there who runs modules in established settings. And may just kind of used material that comes from those settings. There are many GMs who love creating all of that from scratch themselves. And the players show up to play their characters, and that's their contribution to the world. But there's also all sorts of interesting ways you can engage the players in helping to build that world out. And that can come in a lot of different ways. And so I thought we'd talk about ways that we as a GM could take some of that burden of the GM side of building the setting out and kind of creating the world, and put at least a little bit of that into the player's hands and hopefully make it satisfying for them as well.
Yeah. Eddie, why did you choose this topic? This is a topic that we've talked about before on this podcast, as we were discussing before we started recording. This is a topic we've talked about before and discussed, and there is always going to be something to dig into, especially with with tabletop world building, especially, I feel. Why were you drawn to this one?
Well, so first of all, I already take issue with the word burden. So I feel like that you're calling me out, and I don't appreciate that. But but no, I mean, I did pick it because you're right that there the kind of the two ends of the spectrum, if you will, are exactly what you said. I run it exactly from the books with no deviation or derivation or exactly as it's written. And then I made absolutely everything from scratch. I have a binder or a wiki full of setting information, many of which the players will never even see and or care about. And I feel like most games fall between those two. And really, those two are extremes that you almost never see in the wild, right? Like most people are somewhere between those two points. Rarely do they hit the ends. They may be very close to one of those ends, but they really don't. And so I have always found it fascinating that as a designer, I do more world building that players see as a game master than I do as a designer. And we talk more about the design side in the second half, as usual. But for the game master side, like, you're making the world for the players at that moment, in that instance. And they're also making it back to you, regardless of how much authority or authorial intent they want or even subconsciously realize they have. They're still adding to the game and building the world moment by moment, step by step. It's much like a Lego set. Like, you know, you're kind of all building it together. You know, until it's all put together, you don't know what the world looks like until it's done. So you're the game's over, right? And I find that process infinitely fascinating. And it's something that tabletop role-playing games uniquely do that no other art form does exactly the same way.
Just like the fact that you're inviting people, like, it doesn't matter how much of a world you've really built. Okay, I've been on the, like, I'm gonna create a bunch of stuff for this world and then the players aren't ever gonna see it, and I'm just doing it for my own I don't know, my own gratification, my own outlet. But as soon as you get it in front of players, it changes, which is different than it's always going to be different than when you have, like, when you're reading a book, you can't change the book as a reader. What happens in the story is what happens in the story. You can't change a movie. You can barely change a video game. And even then, it's all the pre-planned stuff, right? But in a tabletop game, in a role-playing game like that, in a LARP, you're changing things as you start to interact with it. In a tabletop game, you do it even more than in a LARP, too. It is super fascinating. Very, very cool.
Yeah. Because I do shift a lot between the video game space and the tabletop role-playing game space. I've had to explain the difference to others, and I've also had to keep it straight in my own head. And the metric I've ultimately built for myself is video games tell you what you can do. You can't do it unless it is coded into the game in some way. Tabletop role-playing games tell you what you can't do. They give you the limits on your imagination, but anything that's not within those limits is on the table. And that is the kind of the clear metric between those two designs. So the corollary to that is that then anything that's by consensus the group allows to happen happens, which is where we get into the realm of house rules and personal canon and whatnot. But even more than that, I've come to realize that each tabletop game is its own kind of personal canon. An example is I've worked on a lot of licensed games in my life, and also I've run a lot of licensed games, you know, Star Wars, Marvel, well-known properties, and there are lots of tabletop role-playing games based off of them. And so inevitably becomes a discussion of, well, let me phrase that. It ideally this is a session zero conversation, but sometimes it happens ad hoc for the game, of like how faithful the licensed game is to the canon it's emulating. And I realized, having worked on a lot of these, that the answer is it's never, it cannot be 100% and it cannot be 0%. But what percentage it is very different. So like you can have games like a worker play a Star Wars game, but it also happens to have the Cthulhu mythos in it, which is very clearly low on the accuracy scale, right? But even if you like, no, we're going to play a Marvel Multiversal game and we're going to use the current 2025 Marvel Comics continuity and we're going to reference the events of those continuities, by the fact that players have agency inside of that, they're already changing. They're already moving in a different direction. And so thinking about that, it's like, well, then that's just true of every world building, every tabletop role playing game. Mm-hmm. So once that's on the table, I've talked to people and I've thought about this myself. It's like that actually is freeing. Is the I can't be 100% faithful to the world, which is whether I've written it, whether I've created it, whether it's an existing one. without the player's input. And the players should not feel like they have to be constrained by whatever world they're playing in. Again, whether I'm creating it or whether somebody else has. Mm-hmm. So it's only the consensus of what we agree is quote unquote canon that matters at our table.
I think it can be useful to have that conversation with players, I mean, either as part of session zero or as the kind of the game develops, as you start to push on those boundaries mm-hmm. of canon. And the canon can be like the canon that you've established of your own game that you invented out of whole cloth too. Like you in mm-hmm. your head, you know what that canon is and you're conveying it to the players as you play. So at some point, you know, 10 sessions down, people have a pretty good idea of what's considered part of this world, and having the discussion with the players to say, like, you can push against those boundaries, you know, like a little bit. We can introduce characters that or events that play into some of the other larger events of the story, but that don't, you know, fundamentally change those events. Like we can have characters like my character was involved in this event that took place, but I didn't do something that was like, you know, robbing the story focus from Luke Skywalker at that moment in the story that we all understand, because people are going to expect like, well, Luke Skywalker did certain things and we're not going to interject our character into doing those things. Or you're going to play a game where like, you know, you do that where like you can have that kind of deep immersion where you can be adjusting things and having your characters become more prominent. I mean, hell, the Dragonlance, the original modules were built to do that, where you, yeah. mm-hmm. you could read the modules and say, well, you know, Cameron and Raistlin and Tika and everybody else ran around and did these things. And then you play the game as those characters and do very, very different things, or have your character do something. Like I'm playing Cameron and I have Cameron do something that Sturm did in the book. And that's, you know, you've all accepted the idea that that sort of thing can happen. And then, but just having that conversation and kind of and returning to it every so often and just being like, okay, well, we, you know, and that can be the GM just saying, hey, you know, you did this and this, and those all kind of fell within the boundaries. That's exactly what we're all kind of agreed on. We're all happy with that. Like, let's keep that up. Like, you rah, rah, kind of give everybody a pat on the back and like, let's keep kind of doing what we've been doing. Or if you feel like somebody's maybe pushing a little too far into the boundaries and it's starting to dig into the canon that people don't want to see unchanged, then that maybe needs to be brought up and say, well, how about instead of having you usurp the limelight from this canonical character, how about you were integral to this moment that got that canonical character to that point? But it's this like thing that we didn't see when we watched the movies or read the books or whatever, but it's like clearly like this is an important moment, like somebody that did something that helped the hero on their way. And that becomes like a thing for your character. Having that moment where you touched the other heroes, these known heroes in the canon of the story, but it was still your moment and it wasn't like taking anything away from all of that. And just, you know, having that discussion with the group, amongst the group, and maybe that's an ongoing discussion where anytime somebody kind of introduces something like that, everybody just kind of looks around and like, okay, we all agree that seems pretty reasonable. And if somebody looks at it and goes, well, now we're starting to get into almost like, let's rewrite what you just said, like you almost treat it like a safety tool where it's not about safety, but it's like, we're going to walk it back. Like we went a little too far down the road. Let's walk that back and tweak it a little bit so it doesn't violate kind of the agreement that we all had.
I mean, we're happy in other types of media to have those kinds of moments. I mean, no one was watching Forrest Gump and pointing at the screen and saying, that's not how it happened. And he wasn't there. And I think that like, if you play in any sort of real like historical world, like the canon is like, okay, what are the actual events of this world? And no one is really up in arms like, oh yeah, yeah, Bucky Barnes is the person behind this this assassination. No one's mad about that. And I think like, as long as you're, again, like the golden rule here, like you're talking to your players, you're all setting your kinds of expectations, like no one's gonna get mad about that. And I think also a lot of us are very, very comfortable now, especially like with huge media franchises covering it, like the idea of like multiverses and how like, yeah, this is the same, like things could continue along this path, until you start messing with it. And then like you're literally creating a different canon, and you could include that within like the magic of your world if you have magic, or the sci-fi, or just like the suspension of disbelief. Like there's, I've never really minded it, like ever. Like when I've played a game, like yeah, we're gonna obviously like I want to feel like I can do things, and it is fun to like sort of mess with that in a way. If you want to avoid yeah. that, I think like just avoid having the characters in the same place in the, or either at the same place or at the same time as these canon events were happening. Maybe it's all after it was happening, or you're right. setting it up for things to happen if you really are kind of committed to the canon.
I mean, the best example, honestly, I could think of is the movie Rosencrantz and Guildenstern is basically a bunch of players said, we want to play the Hamlet role-playing game, but not change the events of Hamlet. And that's ultimately what yeah. you get is a bunch of players doing stupid shit in the margins of the story and flirting with each other. So it's basically every role-playing game I've ever played. So, I mean, I was like, yeah, it's exactly it. But like the reason why I bring up the IP component is because then that goes into, I think the best way to approach even your own bespoke world is that if you have created a world that you, and you want that to be presented in a very specific way to your players, and then have the conversation of like, you know, we're going to treat this like it were, you know, an intellectual property that we're all familiar with. So, you know, certain things I'm going to say you can and can't do because there's certain events need to go a certain way. And this brings up the railroading conversation to a degree, right? Is like so much of how we talk about world building is either the game master does all the work or the players have a lot of authority. And the idea that railroading is a negative thing, it generally is. Like railroading is a negative form of world building. But I think that's an interesting component that we don't talk about much, is that railroading is still world building. Yeah. It is just the game master is saying the world is going to go in this direction and you must go in that direction as well. But you can still have a firm hand on it without railroading. So that's why I brought up the IP thing, is like, mm-hmm. of course you're not going to kill Luke Skywalker and take his place and go after Darth Vader unless that's the game you all agreed to.
Of course. Right. Yeah, exactly.
I mean, if you say, no, hey, this is going to be a, like you said, multiversal what if scenario, then everyone's okay, sure, fine. But if the game master is like, I have kind of a plan I need you to go with here, as long as the players know up front, I think it's fine. And a good example of both of these topics, weirdly enough, is I ran a Marvel role-playing game, which was set in the margins between the Marvel movies, because everyone was generally familiar with the MCU movies at that point. And so it's like basically, yeah, all the events are happening kind of in between. You're not the Avengers. You're the SHIELD backup team. That, you know, that in case the Avengers die, we want to make sure we have some more lesser good superheroes on the payroll. But ultimately, it involved time travel. And so there's a lot of, I needed certain things to happen in a specific order because ultimately, you know, cause and effect is being messed with. Now, the trick I used was I didn't tell the players which parts were load-bearing events and which ones weren't. And so I said, hey, there's certain things I need to happen in a certain way because it's a time travel thing. So I'll let you know if you go off the rails. And they said, okay, cool, great. And then just everything, they started touching with sticks, which is exactly what I wanted.
Yeah.
it's like, it's time travel. You don't want to step on the wrong butterfly and cause everything. And I wanted the players to feel the same concern of messing with time streams that the characters you're probably feeling. And in truth, the answer was I just massively kept swapping which NPCs needed to be in which places at what times. Because, and that, the whole conceit, spoilers for a game I ran that nobody else is going to play, but the players were ultimately responsible for creating Kang, which is the time traveler that was causing all the problems. And so basically I threw three or four different characters who could have been him, and whichever one they screwed over was going to be the one that he wanted. That person became Kang and came after them for vengeance. And so it worked out really well because the players the whole time were like terrified of what they had done. And it's like, oh no, we screwed up anyway. Right. But that was the whole conceit of the game. But they did get a chance to punch him in the face at the end, because that's a superhero RPG structure. It's like, you know, the plot resolves with a big fight. That is just how those tropes work. So like I was able to world build, I was able to build a certain structure I had in mind, I was able to do it in a way that get players to buy in and put pretty firm guardrails on. But it didn't involve them telling you have to go in this direction. I didn't use railroading. It was a positive version of the same tactics. So that's sometimes I get a little annoyed when people go, railroading is bad. It's like, railroading in certain instances is bad. Telling players they can't do things is bad. That's the actual problem. Telling players your choices don't matter is bad. But taking choices away from players and limiting their options is sometimes really, really good, especially for players that deal with decision paralysis.
I mean, Craig, you've had a very, very similar suggestion several times on this podcast of like, they don't, what was the example you used? Where you just put the, you put the location in the other location. They're going there instead, yeah. The location over there.
Yeah, I'm not railroading them toward the vampire, but they didn't go to the manor house. And so now the vampire is wherever they go.
Right.
So yeah. And I've remarked like the phraseology, and I think it came out of one of our discussions here and somebody else coined it. But I like using it, which is a little bit of light railroading is fine.
Yeah.
And you know, it goes in line with what Eddie said, which is, you know, don't take away the agency and the having their characters making choices that don't matter. But you know, there can be a certain amount of like things that you're kind of funneling the characters toward to do it for the purposes of, you know, developing a great story. And like, you know, having the characters create Kang, it's just a question of how. You know, that's not terribly different from us watching, you know, reading a book or watching a movie or whatever, where you like, you kind of know what's going to happen, you know, yeah. How it's going to end, but the journey is what's interesting. It's how the decisions that, what are the character decisions and the actions and those consequences and how they get us to that point. You know, right. The hero is going to defeat the bad guy or whatever in certain types of movies. Like, that doesn't mean you don't watch the movie. You know, you yeah. find yourself enjoying like, oh, that was a fun twist. I didn't expect it to do that way. And that you can do that sort of thing with world building, where like you can give the players the opportunities to build pieces, to add things into the world, mm-hmm. to decide my characters do this or my character's background is this. Or I'm even, you know, I'm a big fan of like even letting the characters help to develop, like you're playing an elf. Well, I haven't sat down and figured out everything about what elves are like on my world. Like, you tell me, what's the elf society? Like, you tell me, what's their government? You build that for me. And that can be just a few offhanded comments that you're talking about in character. And then 2 months from now, when we go to see the elves, I've got some ideas about already what that should look like. Yeah. And that's one of the, you know, one of the things, like, you know, sorry, Eddie, using the word burden, but responsibility.
Yeah. I know what you meant.
lessening the responsibility and helping to put a bit of that responsibility on the players, because it, you know, and this all ties honestly in with burnout. Like, it, as yeah. a GM, you can burn out on sure. ideas. You're like, suddenly like, oh, I don't know what, like, they want to go see the dwarves and I haven't thought about the dwarves at all. They decided at the end of the last session and we're playing again in a week and I've got a busy week in front of me. But if you had given them the opportunity to say a few things about the dwarves, at least you have a few inspiring bits that you mm-hmm. can work from, and the players will be satisfied if you built on that. Like they said, I said the dwarves are like this, this, and this, and then they get there and they are, plus whatever mm-hmm. else you added on top of that, there's a sense of like, oh, I helped to kind of build that. Like, I went so far with, you know, designing a game where I leaned heavily into players developing that because I wanted them to help to create the world, because in the game, you're saving the world and it's more satisfying when yeah. you're saving something you created. Which is, you know, which leans into, you know, there's active things you can do as a GM as well, like asking leading questions, like get them to bring that information mm-hmm. to the table for you, whether it's part of session zero or in between sessions where you just ask them about some things that they're interested in or that they'd maybe like to expound on a bit, or you just kind of pepper it into the story. Or just present, it doesn't even have to be in the form of a question. It can just be talking about like, oh, well, there's this, you know, this mysterious mountain. And like, if somebody starts talking about how like, oh, like, you know, and you've given them the freedom to do this. They may pop in and say like, oh, well, you know, my character heard this about this mountain. And another person's like, my character heard this about this mysterious mountain. And then you decide like, well, which one of those is true? Or maybe they're both kind of true and we'll mash it together. Or those are big rumors that are going to like get disproven when they get there, and they're going to discover this other thing that I've suddenly came up with. I mean, there's a lot of ways to for the GM to encourage that collaboration that can be very satisfying for the players when they see it come to life.
Right. I mean, especially in like if you're playing a campaign setting, which is I think where world building while if you're doing it in the midst of the game, that's where it's the most important, because you're going to be coming back to this world, making sure that your characters, like your players, have characters who have a bit of a backstory. Like, okay, like it doesn't have to be that in depth, just a thing that they've done in the past, and maybe a character or two that they would know, somebody in their family, a friend, an ally, an enemy. And then you have all of your NPCs that you already want to make that NPC one of their character background NPCs. Now it feels like they've started building in the world. Even if you were kind of the one who's making that decision, they feel like that, okay, well, now I have that stake there. I've helped build this piece. Even kind of surprising your players with that as you're playing a game. I've had some really great surprises, like, yeah, we're totally gonna go see this wizard in this tower. And then we get there, like, oh shit, that was my childhood best friend who I thought had died. They're a wizard now in this tower. And now I am connected, like my player, my character, I mean, is connected to the story in this way, and I have some agency because it was my character background. It was my character's little village. That's another really good way to kind of get that collaborative world building in play. But you have to really listen to your players when you do that, and make good decisions that you think that they would enjoy.
Yeah, and I mean, that's a piece that I also don't think gets talked about, is that character creation is also world building.
Yeah.
And not even the narrative parts you're talking about. I mean, those are all obviously fantastic. But even just the actual stats on your sheet are world building. You know, if you have a percentage of skill in pistol, if you live in America, that gives you certain options available to you. If you live in other parts of the world, that tells you different things about your character, like where you learn those skills at. What's your if you're particularly strong and handsome, that's going to inspire certain things with the world, because what does attractiveness look like in this world? What does strength look like in this world? Those are all things that have to be answered on some level, and in a lot of games those there's very simple answers to them, but it doesn't take away from world building. And the more you get away from a modern day setting, the more those questions sometimes need to be questioned. So like, example, if you're playing in a fantasy game and you're playing an elf and you have lots of mechanics that reflect them as being attractive, we have a pretty good idea of the classical beauty of elves. But what if you're playing a half-orc, but you're still considered to be heavily attractive? What does that look like in this world? You know, we don't have a common pop culture consensus on what that looks like. So we have to have a conversation. That's world building.
Yeah. No, I mean, calling the character creation as world building, you're right. People don't really, like, when I think about world building, I'm thinking about, like, oh, the setting, and this is all the stuff the GM's doing. And
right.
That's especially where, like, the world building of an established game overlaps with the world building of your campaign or your story, like, a lot, very, very heavily. Like, that's the first meeting point of those two. You might even like make decisions together to say, like, we're not going to have, like, if I was playing a Star Wars game again, we're not going to have Jedi in this one. Like, you can't play a Jedi because that's not the vibe. So why not? Is this a time where there's not Jedi around? Is it post Order 66? Is it
right
in a time where the Jedi are all around, but they're very like, oh, we're like monks and we don't really like associate with the outside world? Like, there are a lot of things that you could do. And then, like, oh yeah, I am playing a Jedi in this world. Why am I away from the rest of these Jedi? Why am I a young Jedi without a master? Like, all of those things can then lead you into that really fun world building, and maybe even take your whole story in a different direction than you had initially wanted. I've been playing Baldur's Gate 3, and I know that's old news. It's been out for 2 years.
Hey,
but That game, the game does a really good job of tying in all of the individual characters into this overall plot that's happening, and thinking about how you can do that with every important character, whether that's your player characters or your NPCs that you're making. How do they fit into this overall, the big direction that you're taking the story? It just makes everything so much more satisfying, and really does give the stakes, like that world building pieces.
Yeah, and honestly, Baldur's Gate 3 is a great example just in general, because the first hour-ish of gameplay throws a lot at you, but you don't realize how much it's throwing at you until it's over. Because basically the whole tutorial is functionally, you're on a crashing airplane, and you wake up when a zombie's trying to mind control your brain and has taken over the brains of all your friends. That's basically the plot of it. But it's like, okay, I'm waking up in this thing. What is this coffin? Who is this guy with tentacles in front of me? What's all this weird technology around me? But it's all centered around people are attacking me and this airship is crashing and I need to stop that. So it's a very understandable action.
I don't have time to investigate. I'm being attacked.
Right. And then when you crash, say, okay, I have a tadpole in my eye. That's apparently bad. So I should probably look into that. And then you start naturally being drawn into the mysteries of the world. And so it's a really good job of, if you've never played any other Baldur's Gate or even in the Realms game, you still get a lot of sense of what's going on, because people are asking you relatively organic questions, having organic conversations with NPCs. And that's also, again, world building, right? It doesn't have to be, here's a 50-page document of stuff you need to read before you can start playing. It's the, okay, well, you know, I get how falling from something from the sky is bad, and I understand how having a tadpole in my eye is bad. You know, so these are basic concepts I can get down because I've watched disaster movies and horror movies, so I get those things. So you can bolt a lot of stuff onto that and then tie it to action. So I think that's the other thing, is like a lot of discussion on world building implies documents and information and prose, and it's like, no, action also builds worlds too. You know, doing things is world building.
Yeah. Do we have anything else to add on world building aside from GM before we get into like, how do we do this? How do we make such a cool, like, how do we make the sandbox as game designers for all of this to happen?
I'm hopefully ready to dive. Well, and that's the question when it comes, like the way the question is posed for the topic, and we'll veer into various subtopics, but how much setting to include as a designer? Like what do you include? You know, and it's interesting because Eddie brought up the whole idea of IPs, and those, you know, generally speaking, include a great deal of setting, because that's kind of what you're going there for that game. Like if I'm playing the Alien role-playing game, I want lots of Weyland Yutani, this and that, and I want interesting planets, and it whether it's canon that we've seen from the movies or comics or whatever, or whether it's something that's invented for the game. And of course, if we know how the sausage is made, it's been approved by the IP holder, so they said, yeah, that stuff fits our IP, then it's all part of the world. But where, you know, I haven't worked on any IPs outside. Well, I mean, I've worked on D&D and, you know, like some stuff, but like no movies and comics and stuff like that, TV shows. And so I often find myself struggling with like, how much setting do I provide in the game book, and how much do I expect the players and the GM to do what we just got done talking about, which is to build out that with world building. Once I give them, as Eddie mentioned, I give them the boundaries, like this is what this game is about. Here's kind of, you're going to design within this area. And I'm interested to see what each of you have to say about all that, because I know we, amongst the group of us, we've delved on every end of the spectrum. We've had we've worked on games where there's been a lot of world that's in setting that's been developed. And then we've worked on games where it's next to nothing.
Yeah.
Because, you know, just as an example, you know, when I developed Die Laughing, it's like I made a list of horror movie tropes, and that's basically the world. It's like you're in the world of a horror movie. It's specifically a horror comedy. So I didn't need to sit there and, you know, design a bunch of like, well, here's a small town and here's a high school and here's a, you know, a ship on the ocean and here's this and here's that and here's a space station. You know, you all know what a horror movie looks like in space. You've all seen, you know, Leprechaun in Space or the fourth Hellraiser movie or
One of those Friday the 13th. Yeah.
Or Alien Resurrection or
Dracula 2000.
Jason X or whatever. So you I don't need to describe all that stuff. So let's dive a little bit into that. Like, what do we like to do and why? It's less about how much setting to include, because really it's what we as the designer feel is appropriate. The question really kind of becomes, how do we make that decision? Yeah. What's the process, the thought process that goes into deciding, okay, this is appropriate. This is the amount of setting I'm going to do.
Yeah. I think bare minimum, you need to like flesh out your setting insofar as it like is related to the mechanics of your world. Like wherever the mechanics touch your setting, you need to explain that. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be like super like in depth. Like for example, in Moonpunk, you're in big glass domes. There's no guns. You cannot have a gun and shoot this dome. You're gonna kill everybody inside, yourself included, and no one's going to do that. Or if you're playing a game like Good Society, having the setting fleshed out so you know like, hey, here are the rules of behaving and interacting and courting, because that is the purpose of this game and these mechanics of this game. You're not going to go around throwing fists at people because here is the setting, where that would be highly inappropriate. So fleshing out, like figuring out where do your rules intersect, like where does the setting matter for your mechanics, is incredibly important. And the more you flesh that out, the easier your players will have, sort of grok those mechanics in a way without having to really over explain the mechanics. Like I don't need to explain super in depth what low grav is, as long as I can say like, hey, you're on the moon, you weigh about this much. Do it that as you will. I don't need to explain everything for that. Or I could if I was really like, we're definitely gonna go do in this mechanics. We're definitely gonna do some like really intense low grav moon gravity stuff, which is not what Moonpunk's about. Maybe then I would describe that. But like, okay, you're like way less. That's enough for whatever I'm doing with these mechanics. And the more you explain, the more important it becomes, which is something I've said.
Right, exactly. And this is a case where weirdly licensed games are bad, because the normal metric should be whatever got players excited to play this game, how much knowledge are they bringing into that? So let's go back to Die Laughing for a second. If you're playing Die Laughing, you're probably familiar with horror films. That's why you're picking up this game and playing it to begin with. So we can assume a certain amount of horror movie trope knowledge going in that we don't have to explain. If I'm writing a game, as a random example that I totally didn't work on recently, a post-apocalyptic game where you solve all of your fights between ancient demons with wrestling, I have to assume a certain amount of wrestling knowledge you're bringing into a game like that, you know?
Right.
At least you probably watched WWE back in the 80s or whatever, you know, something.
Wait, it's not Greco-Roman style wrestling? I'm not wearing... what do they call those? What do they call those little bodysuits?
The sarong or whatever. Yeah. But it's professional bullshit American style wrestling. Absolutely, you know what that is. And so like you get a certain amount of, okay, there's going to be pomp and circumstance. It's going to be lots of improbable moves. It's going to be very colorful characters. And it's like, oh, okay. And I also know about angels and demons from at least a pop culture perspective. Maybe I've seen, you know, Constantine or Hellboy or whatever. So it's like, okay, I see how colorful characters maps to angels and demons. So like just by me telling you the concept, you've already got like certain singlet. Thank you. That was the word, Greg.
Singlet.
So wrong. What the hell am I talking about? So those kinds of settings that you don't need to explain, but again, that's why licensed games are a bit weird, because to Craig's point, part of the joy of that is separately reading a big book of lore. That's a case where it's not a good to emulate that. But to your point, like what you envision players doing most often is the thing you should be talking about. If Cyberpunk Red needs to talk about doing crime in the dark future, so we need to talk about what dark future stuff, we need to talk about crime stuff. That's going to be a lot of what the setting could revolve around discussing. as the game grows and evolves, we can then go into other areas like, what do MMOs look like in Cyberpunk Red? But like, they don't need that in the core rulebook. And that's another component of like, if you have lots of things you want to put in your setting, if they're not part of the core experience of the game and you're planning to do supplements for it, expansions for it, then you can put those in other books down the line. But really, you should be putting in as much setting as players will find satisfying. So how do we come up to that? Honestly, it's like you said, Jessica, it's what are your mechanics telling you? If it's going to be a game that's... Actually, here's a great example. One of the games I worked on recently was a licensed game. It's a personal license. A friend of ours had a webcomic called Steam Wars, which is about giant steam-powered robots in a different World War I. And they're very much Voltron-style robots in the sense that like, the entire crew are all in one robot. And so it's like, okay, obviously how combat looks and how robots work are important things, but the other piece that we quickly realized we need to go into detail was the socio-political setting of early 20th century Earth and how that has been massively changed by this this new kind of technological military power. And so that radically changes not just Europe, but it changes how America falls into structure, how Asia falls into structure. The conflict between China and Japan becomes radically different because they had a pretty big war right before World War II. And so like if that war changes and accelerates, that changes a huge chunk of the world's economy. So I spent a lot of time talking about politics in this military game because you had to understand the context of why you were fighting. So like it's the thing you're doing is fighting, but why you're doing it also becomes an important part. And so like, okay, we do have to explain this piece as well, which is not a concept we have explained in most of the games we rewrite.
This was my hell when I was making the Dune LARP. I had to figure out how can I need to explain all this stuff to people who have no idea what Dune is so they can understand what's going on in their character sheet. And these people don't know all the, these people know the whole natural life cycle of a worm, and these people don't, and then all of this, and then the politics, and then the history, and then I have to change some of the stuff. It was a lot. So I had to write a whole little spiel about a war, like a civil war. But yeah, it was a lot. It was so much fun to do. And when I was fleshing all of that out, it helped me understand the focus of the game a little bit more as well. Like that's for a LARP, which is a little bit more story driven than like you have a specific story. It's like combination creating a game and a module all at once. But that can also help you when you're designing your game while you are researching your world building. Like for example, okay, I'm gonna research this aspect of the World War One flyboys. Mm-hmm. You might come up with some really interesting stuff to add into your game in the future, or again, make a spinoff style too. And the stuff that you're going to be passionate about and write about in your game is going to be the stuff that people are going to latch onto because your passion and your excitement for that is going to shine through.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that was a big example. I've had the privilege of working with Chris Spivey on a few projects, and both the Harlem Unbound, which was about Harlem Renaissance in the 1920s, and also Haunted West, which was about a lot of the actual history of the American West. Both of those games were very much meant to be, these are what-if scenarios, but Chris correctly felt that understanding the plight of, just keeping it to Harlem Bound for a second, understanding the plight of Black Americans in the 20s and 30s and how that relates to the mythos, you had to have all that context to understand what he wanted to do with Harlem and what it would do with Cthulhu as a result of that. It unfortunately, I think, has ended up painting a bit of a picture of like, you have to play according to the history. And that was never the intent of either of those books. I've read them and worked with Chris. But it's a case of you have to know what the rules are before you can break them, right? And so to your point, like if you want to do a Dune game, people have to know a certain amount of backstory so they can make informed decisions with their characters. Otherwise it's the, I don't know, can I just shoot this guy who's floating in a chair? It's like, no, this is why you can't shoot Baron Harkonnen. That's a bad idea.
Why do I care about Chome?
Right. Yeah. Spice. Why is everyone so worried about coriander? I don't get it.
Yeah, all that stuff is like especially if you're writing for an IP, like, so that's the most difficult thing. And we've talked about writing for IPs before, and that's like, it's like really, really hard. And when you're making your own stuff, now you don't even have the limitations of what already exists in the IP. You have to You have to make it up. You have to say why. You have to come up with those reasons. I was saying before we started recording that my thoughts on how much setting to include in your game has evolved since I've been writing games. Mm-hmm. When I GM a game and I'm making a campaign for my friends to play in, I want to completely homebrew a setting. I rarely want to do something in an established sort of piece. I want to make new NPCs. I want to make new places. I want to make new rules for the world. And that's my style of gameplay. I have learned that that is not what a lot of people want. A lot of people want the play place to be already set up. They want all of those. They want the setting there. They want NPCs there. They want places there. They want a ready to go world that then they can play around with and mess around with and customize. Mm-hmm. And it took me a long time to kind of like come to grips with that. And because of that, a lot of my games, like my two biggest games that I've come up with, which were pretty early in my game writing career, don't have a lot of that setting built in that I would have actually added were I to redesign them now. Because you are asking, when you're not including those things, you are asking whoever is running this game to include them for you. You're passing along that burden to them. You can always write setting and write all these things and do all this world building, then give it to the players, and then they can decide, nah, I'm going to do it this other way instead. They always have the option to be creative, but you won't have the option to add that setting in after you've published, after you finish the game.
Unless you're going to write a giant setting supplement.
Yeah, of course. Right.
Nothing but setting, no rules. Yeah. I think those are called novels, Craig.
I grew up on third edition, second and third edition Forgotten Realms, where there were plenty of books that were just like, here's a little bit of rule stuff up front, and then there's like, here's everything you ever wanted to know about the Dale Lands.
Oh yeah, no, totally. Yeah,
and I love that. Like, I have a little book right in my bookshelf. I'm looking at it right now. I'm like, that had so much cool stuff that I never used, but I like looking at it.
Yeah. And at the very least, you're giving those GMs inspiration. You're giving them ideas. Like, they'll pick and choose. Like, oh, that's a neat hook that this NPC has. I want to devise my own NPC, but they're going to have that particular problem that you gave this NPC.
Right, and I think you both hit on something that's really important. Is that a lot of times people, when they want to run games, they may want to be creative on different levels, but they also have to kind of know what to do and what rules to break. So if it's a blank page, if it's just like, just make up your own setting, a lot of people will freeze up and just go, I don't want to play this game. But if it's we're going to run Shadowrun, but we're going to set it in this year, we're going to change all these and throw these books out and add these books in or whatever, that feels more comfortable to them because they're like, okay, I want to tweak things. And so the analogy that always goes in my head is the Aristocrats joke, which for those who don't know, the Aristocrats joke is basically a guy comes in and talks about this new act he found for a variety show. And oh, tell me about the act. And then the joke teller will fill the middle bit of that joke with the most depraved actions they could possibly describe. And it's always unique to the person telling the joke. And then the punchline is, what are they called? They're called the Aristocrats. And so like, the joke structure is identical for each Aristocrats joke, but the part in the middle is completely different every time someone tells that joke. And it tells you something about them a little bit. So like, if you just say, tell me a joke, then you're like, ah, I can't think of a joke right now, it'll save my life. But if you say, hey, tell me the Aristocrats joke, add your own bit in the middle, they have a part that they know they can say, they can walk up to it and then feel free to add the as much or as little in the middle as they want to, because the joke does not change depending on how much or little you add to it. I've heard a version of Risk It jokes last 15 minutes. It's ridiculous.
There's a whole documentary about it. So, if you don't mind incredibly crude and offensive,
yes,
like descriptions of really lewd acts.
Which is wild in a cartoon movie about cats. Like, I just didn't
know. No. The aristocrats.
Very, very different thing.
The crats, not the cats, Jess. Wouldn't that be a hell of an Aristocrats joke if somebody described like the characters from the Aristocats doing all these terrible things? Anyway.
Meta. But yeah, so like a lot. So yeah, if you're trying to figure out like how much to add, I mean, the actual answer is like as much as you want, which is not very helpful. But certainly it's easier to pull away details from your setting that aren't needed than it is to ask players to add them. So like Jess says, like that's when it does become a burden, because it's the I need to add setting to even play this game. Then the people running the game have a certain amount of upfront work they have to do before they can even get started. Mm-hmm. And that can feel like a burden, because it's like, this is work. I'm not enjoying it necessarily. Some people don't enjoy world building.
I didn't just buy a game. I bought homework.
Exactly. Right. Exactly. But if it's the game's here and I could run this out of the box, nearly nobody ever does that. As we said before, you know, the act of creating a play in the game ultimately changes and deforms it. So like, you never play it rules as written. I hate that phrase. So you're always making changes to it. So like, but if you have something to start from, that is much easier to do. Is that, okay, we could, whenever we have a question or we're not sure what to do, we can go back to the setting and build from there.
Yeah. I mean, people are going to buy the game too because of the setting. I don't know a lot of game players who are not also game designers that will buy a book because the mechanics sounded really cool. They're buying it because the premise of the game was interesting. The premise of the game that most people are going to focus on is what stories are we going to be able to tell in this? And like, you could, like, maybe your mechanics really, really do support that kind of game and support that kind of setting. And there are some games that don't really need it. Again, Die Laughing. Yeah, the whole point is we know what this kind of story is. We know what a scary movie is, a B horror movie. I can do that. Two hands tied behind my back. You can't really do that in your cool, unique world that you are building for your, like, you know, like you, at some point you're going to need to give them that premise and then flesh that story out so they can and then will be interested in buying it. And that way they can experience how really super cool your rules are. And then maybe the next time they play it, they'll make their own world up.
That is such a designer comment, though.
Yeah.
I can speak to a couple of the decision points I hit with different games, which was with Capers. Capers, it contains fairly good size write-ups for New York City, Atlantic City, and Chicago. And it's that happened for a couple of reasons. One, because those are the three main setting cities for Boardwalk Empire, which largely inspired the game, because that's what I was watching when I was like, oh, what if they were superpowered? and so I just had a lot of information that I learned from just the show. And then I did more research and whatnot. I actually had help other people writing stuff as well. But the point being that each of those cities, it has a different feel. So like Atlantic City is like, there's one guy that's kind of in charge of the whole city. New York City is a whole bunch of different gangs that have like these uneasy truces between them. They're all controlling different parts of the city, but it's tense all the time. And then Chicago is kind of a city at war. There's two primary gangs. And this is all historically based, and they're at each other's throats. There's violence happening all the time. And so, you know, that was a choice to be like, I'm going to give three different settings that people can play in if they want to have like a particular experience. And then they can also, if they want, they can have their characters travel around. With Cosmic Corsairs, which is coming to Kickstarter soon, that was, I was figuring out like, well, okay, how much setting am I going and what sort of setting am I going to include? Well, at the heart of the game is flying around on starships in this 10 planet solar system. So immediately the thought became, I'm not going to over describe any particular place because the characters are going to be flitting from one place to another. So I'm not going to give you two pages on a space station because right. they're probably only going to be at that space station once, maybe occasionally kind of, you know, scattered out if they have like NPC contacts or something there. But I'm going to hit like these three major planets that have a lot going on and like the moon bases and the space stations and things around them. As well as, you know, starships and warships and NPCs. And then I've got a subsection in the setting area called Elsewhere, which is like, okay, and here's a whole bunch of other things at all different other planets. So I've got a reason for you to fly to any planet because there's at least one interesting thing happening. So that'll keep everybody moving.
Makes sense.
And that's how the setting for that got developed was like, but now like next game in this game line is going to probably, you know, there's going to be a lot more detail because we're going to be dealing with characters who are working politically within the triarchy, the you know, terrible government, the dark regime that kind of runs the solar system, trying to take it down from within. So I'm going to be giving, if you're working at this planet in this part of the government, here's a whole bunch of information about that. It's going to get more like the Capers treatment. I'm not going to be giving you information about every, you know, there's not going to be something at every planet. It's going to be like three or four major areas that are going to get a lot of detail. And then that, again, to the point that we've all been making, that gives something that's fresh, that's ready out of the box to anybody that wants to play. And it gives just a bunch of ideas. If somebody says, well, I would like to go and have my story take place on this other planet that isn't described in depth, and I've got an idea for what's politically happening there and how the characters can be undermining the government and working in like this secret cell and trying to overthrow this particular NPC or this faction or whatever. And that to an extent, you know, like is what Jess said about like touching on what the mechanics are about. Like I have a whole section on starships and I know what, you know, you're gonna have stats for your starships and you got laser cannons on those starships. And so I need to make sure that the characters are flying around blowing shit up with starships. So they need places to go blow shit up.
Yep, exactly. For me, we worked on, I had a team of people working on this, so it's not just me, but I was involved in conversations for a game called Curseborn, which is our modern horror game where you play monsters. And so like immediately certain setting decisions, you know, we have to describe the monsters, different kinds of monsters, their supernatural powers, and then any elements that touch on supernatural powers, like ghosts, which means we have to discuss how death works, going to different dimensions and how that works. But by the days of we want the game to do X, that certain amount of things we have to build. But then we also very much wanted to appeal to people who are familiar with other modern horror games like The World of Darkness or Monster Hearts or whatnot, which tend to have a lot of relationships with families and or social groups. And also one more mystery. There's never an end to the mystery chain. You're always finding another thing. So we ended up having to do, we did a lot of behind the scenes world building, and then we kind of kept cutting it down and cutting it down and cutting it down to just what is necessary to understand early days as a monster. Because we simply wanted to say, you know, imply things that we'll then reveal later down the road. So that was a case of intentionally pulling stuff away because of the very specific feel we were going for. But then it became not what setting to put in, but which ones do we leave behind? Because like, it's important to know, like, for example, how ghosts work, because that's one of the playable options is you could play a ghost. So it's okay, we have to have a pretty good, clear sense of how that works. But you don't have to answer the afterlife right now, because they haven't got to the afterlife yet because they're ghosts, they're stuck here. So we don't have to explain that part yet. We also had the additional challenge of we very much wanted to have a lot of the book given through the course through character dialogues, which and the characters are designed to be unreliable narrators. So one thing is that I have learned is that players hate it when NPCs lie. And especially they hate when NPCs lie in books. So we have to be very clear when we're saying something that's not true for our setting, but the character believes it to be true, because we want to show that there's diversity of opinion. Again, all of these things kind of help to constrain what kind of decisions you're making when you're world building of like, okay, certain opinions, maybe we're just not going to present at all, because it's going to be too confusing. There were a couple of things that we ended up having to rework and pull out because we wanted to introduce nuance that just made the whole thing muddier than it needed to be. Sometimes you have to just be clear. And it's a lot of what they're saying has to be true because they are ultimately conveying the setting. There's other things you have to think about, like how you're conveying the setting. The images you commission if you get artists involved, not only just the words on the page, but like even what kinds of words you use convey setting. For example, if you look at, say, Vampire the Masquerade specifically, but the older World Darkness books, there's lots of capitalized letters, and people used to give White Wolf a lot of stick for that, but that was intentional. They were trying to specifically evoke 19th century Gothic literature, which used that trope a lot. So it wasn't because we don't know how language works. It was because, no, we're trying to evoke a very specific literary style with that game. And so that gives you long comp words like puissance and obfuscate. They use those Baroque words because that was the literary tradition we were drawing from and trying to emulate. That's another way to convey setting, is how you write this stuff out, how you present it can also convey setting in these subtle ways.
Yep. In Capers, you have conveyances and fisticuffs.
Right.
as vehicles and unarmed combat. Yeah, I played Vampire, you can tell.
Yeah, with some exactly. Of
the terminology I used. It's the 20s.
But yeah, and it's funny because I've been reading a bunch of Green Hornet comics recently. And yeah, right, the 20s is that very weird blend of erudite speaking combined with mind-wrenching violence. But there's a very specific tone that you want to convey of like people with these eloquence while they're beating the shit out of you. So it's important to kind of get that across.
Yeah. Whereas that kind of language wouldn't have worked with moonpunk. Now you can't.
Right.
We don't use big words on the moon.
We use big words on the moon.
Yeah.
I love it.
It's the moon. It's one syllable. Come on. No, I'm thinking now, I think we need to add this as a topic, like basically applying your English class knowledge to writing your book, writing the prose of your book.
Yeah.
Now I'm thinking about all sorts of examples where that is like super effective. But we're reaching the end of our time here. So let's wrap up with some of our final thoughts on this topic of setting. Like I said, we could go. We've talked about this before. We can continue talking about it. There is a lot.
I would just say then, if people want to know from the design perspective, it actually wouldn't hurt to look into some writing how-to books, because there are lots of books about how to write a novel and how to create the world for your novel that work really well. Also, on the flip side, there's a fair number of world building video game books that's much more from a technical perspective, but they usually involve lengthy discussions on how to make world building design documents. None of them have a direct application to RPG design, but between the two is the middle ground of where you want to be with RPG design. So looking into, if you like to read to get information, those are two points to kind of start looking into tips and tricks and things that can really help you dial things in.
I would throw out there just one thing too to keep in mind is that your personal preference for writing that sort of stuff comes into play.
Yep.
I design games of a certain size because that's the size of game I want to design. Like if you want to write 200 pages of setting, there's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
Even if it's a relatively simple game. With a relatively simple rule set and so forth. Like there's an audience for that. There are players who will gobble that up. They'll be like, oh my God, look at this book with all these cool illustrations. And there's all this information about this whole world. I can just dive in and swim around in it. And then there are other people that are going to pick and choose what they want out of it. but they dig the game, like Jess said, they dig the game concept. So they don't mind getting a whole bunch of setting because they know they can mine it for ideas, even if they're not going to use it, you know, right out of the book.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, Eddie, thank you so much for coming to talk with us today.
I was happy to come on whenever I can make the time, because now we're in different time zones now. It's all weird. Yeah.
Where can we find you and your stuff and your cool world building?
Actually, my website is pugstudy.com, and I do have on there some of the talks I've done on various topics. I think I do have at least one world building deck, PowerPoint deck I put up there. So definitely go to pugstudy.com. I have some other resources there as well, as well as all the stuff I've worked on. And then also pugstudy.com is my blue sky handle. I should make that all into one word somehow. Blue scandal.
Ooh.
My blue sky handle. Find me there. And yeah, those are the best places to kind of fat in. I'm happy to chat about it online either.
You can find me on blue sky at my blue scandal. It's Jocelyn. you can find me there. You can find me on Discord there too. And you can find my games at wannabegames.itch.io. And yeah, that's it for me.
And my blue scandal is Nerdburger Craig.
No!
Yeah, you can find the games at nerdburgergames.com, as well as at drivethroughrpg.com. And the Cosmic Corsairs Kickstarter is coming on Tuesday, October 7th. So if you want to fly all over the solar system and, you know, blow up some Triarchy moon bases and starships and channel the power of a comet, then check out the game.
Thank you to Steph Sachs for our opening and closing theme song, which is Avel, licensed under Creative Commons. Thank all of you for listening. We'll see you back here next time. Bye.
Bye.